for Monday, February 23rd. I want to welcome everyone. I know we have some other senators who will be arriving shortly. Today's topic is on diversity and demographic trends in charter schools. And we've had this discussion throughout some of our other meetings, and this is an opportunity for us to hear a little bit more about, you know, our current statutes and our understandings or perhaps our misunderstandings about how these work in Minnesota. And then we have our favorite state demographer here, Dr. Tom Gillespie, who's going to be talking about demographic trends in Minnesota. Then we're going to have Dr. Les Fuzichaki, who is with the who's with Bloomington Public Schools, talking about integration policies and specific situations that have impacted their schools. And then we also want to talk a little bit about special education services in charter schools. And we have some parents here who have served on charter school boards to have that discussion. So with that, I wonder if Ms. McQuay and Mr. Corte might be willing to brief us on some of the background that I asked them to do. And perhaps if they could go through the information, and we'll ask them if they would like us to ask questions as they go along by each section or wait until the end. And I believe that we have a handout. It is a memo to the Charter School Working Group that have some of these statutes highlighted in them. And Ms. McQuay, Dr. McQuay, and Mr. Corte, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Yes, I was basically asked by the working group to get together and pull together the statutes which kind of pertain to charter schools and diversity and demographics, as we were asked to talk about today. So if you refer to the memo, I divided it into two sections. Basically, one is the purposes of charter school legislation and what this legislation, by its text, seems to envision for the system. And then the second part is just the rules and kind of how diversity issues are addressed within the charter school system. So just starting on the first part with the U.S. Code, as you see, I highlighted the pertinent portions of this. In this first, it defines a charter school as a public school in accordance with state statute authorizing the granting of charters to schools, but in states it's exempt from state or local rules that inhibit the flexible operation and management of public schools. Later on in that statute, also discusses that there are certain federal amendments that do apply to all, or federal statutes that apply to all charter schools. Then also within state law, states that a charter school is a public school and part of the state system of public education. Except as provided in this section, a charter school is exempt from all statutes and rules applicable to a school, board, or district. Also, skipping out of Subdivision 19, it states that when disseminating information about charter schools and how to form and operate charter schools, that particular groups to be targeted include low-income families and communities and students of color. So basically, in summary, the laws as a whole kind of suggest that the purpose of charter schools is to be more free from kind of get more flexibility than what exists in the standard traditional public school system. As it's applied in the administrative rules, moving on, the rules talk about racially identifiable schools within a district. Whether a charter school is considered a district is kind of a strange thing. From what I'm told, they're not considered a district, or they are not a district, but they're considered a district. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and committee, for the purposes of payments, they're considered to be a district. Otherwise, in all other situations, it would be as noted in the statute.
Okay. So within, when talking about segregation and integration, the rules define a racially identifiable school within a school district as a school where the enrollment of protected students at the school within a district is more than 20 percentage points above the enrollment of protected students in the entire district for a grade level served by that school. As mentioned, when we're talking about a district, you can't really, since a charter school is not a district within the traditional sense, this racially identifiable school term doesn't really apply well to charter schools. As far as how charter schools are worked into this statute, it says in subpart A, for purposes of these parts, a school does not mean a charter school is under the Minnesota statutes. And then there's also a number of other types of schools which are not included in the definition of schools within this statute, or within these rules, I should say. So basically what we end up dealing with is that there's two situations where there are there's segregation and there's integration. And basically with segregation, it means that there's been an intentional act by a school or a school district that has a discriminatory purpose of causing a student to attend or not attend based upon that student's race. Now, every school, including, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the district could, or the department could clarify this, but as I understand it, charter schools are required to report to the commissioner the racial demographics within their school, and then the commissioner is required to look at those demographics and determine if it's a racially not racially identifiable school per se, but I guess I'll have to have the department maybe clarify that for me. I'm sorry. But basically what it comes down to is that if the commissioner determines that there's actual segregation within a school, that is, whether there's a discriminatory purpose, then the commissioner is allowed to institute a desegregation plan. But now, if you flip to the last page, it comes to integration. If it's found that there is, like I said, racially identifiable school, just as it's defined in the past, or in the section, if it's not a result of the segregation, the school district, if in a regular school district, the commissioner would be able to institute an integration plan. This is not the case with charter schools. 3535.0160 does not apply to charter schools.
So are there questions from anyone on? Because it's very complicated, and I think just to understand the difference between segregation, integration, and having the department, perhaps if Morgan Brown could just come up in just a second to talk about how we actually implement or how these things really play out in terms of how they're applied to our schools in Minnesota. But are there questions at this point? Because essentially what I understand is that charter schools, that these rules do not apply to charter schools in terms of the integration programs that are in place in the state. Would that be correct, Mr. Corte?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Is when it comes to the commissioner is not authorized to institute any type of integration plan within a charter school.
Good. And also because a charter school is not part of a district, even though it may be in a district that is identifying schools that need to be integrated, a charter school would be exempt from that because they are a sort of a standalone school.
Yeah,
would that be correct?
That is, Madam Chair, that is correct. The way that the statute is written, it uses the word district, and as I noted before, it's not talking about district as in geographic area because a charter school is kind of a district unto itself.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, there's some questions. Senator Olson. Well,
Madam Chair, I presume that one factor also is that that school has been chosen by the families rather than being assigned, which is more likely to lead to a segregated situation. So,
are there other questions from committee members? And there may be some. So this is excellent. Thank you so much for providing this background. I think it's very helpful for us because this is scattered over rulemaking and statute, but thank you so much. Maybe just stay at the table, and if Mr. Brown would come up, I just wanted to ask a little bit, a few questions regarding how does it work when the commissioner intervenes, or how is integration applied? At what point are there some examples of where the commissioner has determined that and a plan has to be put in place?
Madam Chair, are you asking with regard to charter schools or more generally for the process of the DSEG rule and the integration statute?
The process for the DSEG rule, okay. And then has it ever been put in place for a charter school? I think, right. I know the answer to that, but perhaps if you would just respond. And again, because I think that we're trying to compare the rules under which our district schools operate and those of our charter schools. And right. Are there issues in this regard related to either one of them, especially when you have schools that are very similar and they are located next to each other? One set of schools play under one set of rules, and others might play under another. So,
Madam Chair, members, just to clarify, probably the easiest way to explain the intersection between charter schools and the integration revenue law and the DSEG rule is that there is no intersection. I mean, neither the DSEG rule nor the integration revenue law applies to charter schools. The charter school law doesn't reference that statute or rule, and neither does the rule or statute reference the charter school law. And I think, as you mentioned, since charter schools have no geographic boundary, essentially they exist under the open enrollment statute and can serve, theoretically, any student in the state. Since they have no geographic boundaries, it would be difficult to apply the rules of the DSEG rule in terms of how you measure whether you have a racially identifiable school or a racially isolated district. And as you also referenced, or as Senator Olson referenced, there are also schools of choice. There are other examples, and I think actually you see this in this excerpt, of other types of schools that are specifically exempted from certain parts of the DSEG rule, and particularly all different types of alternative schools for similar reasons in that they are schools of choice and they have a specific focus, and sometimes they also, like area learning centers, can cross specific school district boundaries.
Okay, very good. Excuse me, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brown, you referenced the idea that there's no intersection between charter schools and the DSEG laws because the charter schools operate under the
Madam Chair, Senator, the usually for a provision to have an impact on charter schools, it has to be specifically referenced in the charter school law or in its separate statute. In this case, it would be the integration revenue law or the DSEG rule itself that has to reference that it applies to charter schools, and neither is the case here. There is references in the DSEG rule, for instance, in its purpose, to the importance of parental school choice. But nowhere does it reference that it applies to charter schools. And as you heard from the other testifiers here, the language used specifically in the DSEG rule, and I think believe also in the integration revenue law, is school district, which is not synonymous with charter school in that section of the statute.
Madam Chair.
Please go on.
So in terms of open enrollment, are there any and this is just when you said that, just a brand new thought crossed my head. Does open enrollment get impacted by the desegregation rule? And I'm thinking of the choice is yours. I'm thinking
right.
also of,
Madam Chair, Senator, not for charter schools because they.
I'm just talking about open enrollment in general.
In general. For open enrollment in general, the impact, the intersection between the integration revenue statute, DSEG rule, and open enrollment law primarily deals with the January 15th deadline. You may be familiar, in most districts, you have to apply by a January 15th deadline to be considered by the district for, where to be, where the district must consider you for open enrollment of their space after the January 15th deadline. It's left at the district's discretion that you which that you wish to enroll into. In the open enrollment law, however, it says if the district that you either that you're coming from or that your district of residence or that you're enrolling into is part of an integration plan under the DSEG rule, then the January 15th deadline is waived and you may open enroll at any time. And the district is supposed to accept you if there's space under the open enrollment statute.
Senator Brummel.
If that open enrollment changes the status of the DSEG classification, I'm thinking we live very, White Bear is very close to North St. Paul, mm-hmm. and North St. Paul has just been designated as, I forget what the exact title is, but they have
The percentage of students.
A racially isolated school district.
So they're racially isolated. Thank you. If it affects the that kind of a status, is there anything that open enrollment covers or doesn't cover?
Madam Chair, Senator, my understanding is that's one of the reasons that was the intent for when you're under an integration plan with other districts around you, why the January 15th deadline is waived, because one of the purposes of the DSEG rule is to facilitate parent choice, and so the idea was that it would allow parents potentially to move and so that there would be more fluidity in terms of whether that racial balance could change. Now, obviously, that can go either way, but there's nothing that prohibits, for instance, a parent from open enrolling from one district to another because it might have an impact on the calculation, that differential calculation that determines whether one school district is racially isolated as compared to an adjoining district.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How has the Choices Your program affected the participating districts and Minneapolis in terms of their segregation and desegregation?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have specific numbers for you, although I'd be happy to get those. In general, because the Choices Yours program, originally under the settlement between the state and the Minneapolis NAACP, and then when that settlement expired, it was adopted by the integration district, which is made up of Minneapolis and the western suburbs and is referred to as the West Metro Education Program. So this program was adopted as part of their integration plan, their integration project. Because the eligibility for that program is limited to students who are qualified for free and reduced lunch, in Minneapolis, it predominantly impacts students of color. And we do know, for instance, that prior to the Choices Yours program coming into place and the major change there's a number of things that happened, but the major change is that because it's under the settlement and under the integration plan, the state covers the cost of transportation for those students from Minneapolis to the suburbs. The majority of students utilizing open enrollment to go from Minneapolis to suburbs were white, and since the Choices Yours program, the majority are now African American. And we could get you more specific stats on that, but it certainly has. Minneapolis would have to respond on what has happened there, but it certainly has brought more students of color into the suburban districts that participate in that program with Minneapolis.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions? So thank you very much, and we appreciate your time with us today. And at this time, I'd like to call forward Dr. Gillespie. And I thought it would be helpful for us to sort of see a trend in Minnesota. We have certainly heard from Dr. Gillespie before on some of the changing trends in Minnesota, and I thought this may be helpful for us as we look at, you know, diversity in our state and what the trends are, especially as we move forward. And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the working group, my name is Tom Gillespie, and I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Minnesota Department of Administration. I've also asked Dr. Martha McMurray, my colleague in the demography office, to join me here. She has recently completed a report on trends in minority populations in Minnesota over the decade to date, as well as forecast out to 2035. So we're very fortunate. Some of the material that I will present will be material that she has recently completed. You should have a brief handout. If I can just go over a few of the items here. Minnesota is changing. We are becoming an increasingly diverse state, but at this time we are not very diverse. So far this decade, over half of our total population growth has been in minority populations. We have seen an increase of a little over 2% in our majority white population, but our minority population has increased more than 28%, with the largest increases in the Hispanic or Latino population of about 43%, followed by the Black or African American population at nearly 28%, and the Asian population at nearly 24%. Minnesota, as well as the nation, are becoming increasingly diverse nationally. We will, by 2035, we will be approaching 50% of our population. Just slightly under half of our population will be minority persons nationwide. Minnesota's most diverse county, which is Ramsey County, and the second most diverse county, which is Hennepin County, are less diverse than the national average today. The national average is nationally the national average population is more racially and ethnically diverse. Ramsey and Hennepin County, like the rest of the state, will be increasingly diverse. By 2035, Ramsey County, we are projecting, will approximate the national population in racial and ethnic diversity. Hennepin County will still be noticeably less. The Twin Cities will increase in diversity substantially over the next 20 years, but will still be substantially less diverse than the national average at about 35% of the population. So a little over a third of the population by 2035 will be minority race or ethnicity in the Twin Cities. The minority populations of Minnesota, as is true also nationally, are heavily concentrated in the younger age groups, particularly younger families and their children. Much of the change that we are seeing in Minnesota is being driven by migration, people moving here from other states and from other countries, is changing our racial and ethnic composition. And because these are younger populations, they're also more likely to have children, and as a result, the combination of relatively young age population, a bit higher fertility rates, and migration combined to create a population of minority persons that is substantially younger than the total population. And as we look to the older population of Minnesota, is much, much less diverse than our school age population is today, and that will likely continue well into the future. If we look at trends, recent trends in enrollment so far this decade, in both the Twin Cities and in the rest of the state, we have seen a decline in the majority white students, but increases in minority students of all races and ethnicities. Overall in the state, we've seen a bit of a decline in overall enrollments that is being driven totally by the declines in the majority white students. The increases in enrollments of students of color is offsetting that overall decline in the majority white students. Our high school graduating class will become increasingly diverse. Today, this year, approximately 16% of our high school graduates will be students of color. By the middle of next decade, that will increase to over 20%, and we will continue to see increases in the proportion of our high school graduates who are students of color. Diversity is not just a one-dimensional kind of aspect. Another dimension, and there are many other possible dimensions, but another dimension is culture, language, national origin. And here, one of the things that we have seen over time in Minnesota has been an increase in students who speak a language other than English at home. The three predominant languages in Minnesota right now are non-English languages, are Spanish, Hmong, and Somali. Hennepin and Ramsey County combined, for example, have seen a modest decline in the number of students who speak Hmong at home. That is probably not due to a decrease in the number of Hmong students. It's, as I understand, more likely a decrease in the number of students who speak Hmong at home as successive generations age and in Minnesota. Spanish has been a rapidly increasing language in Hennepin and Ramsey County. Somali has also increased as a language in number, but there are other languages, many other languages that are being spoken. Even the number of languages that are being spoken in our schools has increased this decade. We are now seeing more than 80 different languages spoken in our schools in Minnesota. And this is still substantially less than the national average. About 11%, 11.5% of our students speak a language other than English at home, compared with about 20% nationally. One out of every five students nationally speaks a language other than English at home. St. Paul is the most language-diverse school district in Minnesota, with about 44% of the student body speaking a language other than English at home, and it's a very large number of languages, and the number of languages continues to increase, and we see languages that increase over time. For example, in the 1980s, we saw Hmong rise as a very common language in our schools. Later in the decade, we began to see Russian increase in substantial numbers as the breakup of the former Soviet Union was occurring, and increasing numbers of people were immigrating from Russia. By the middle of the 90s, we began to see Somali as a language. Some of the languages that are increasing right now include Karen from Myanmar is increasing in number. Creole, a language that is spoken by students from the Ivory Coast area of Africa, as well as many other languages. We continue to see strong, large numbers of students who speak Oromo, who speak Eritrean, and many other languages. It is not just one or two languages. It's the very number of languages continues to increase. Nor is this purely a central city issue. We're seeing rapid change in some of the suburban school districts, such as Richfield, Brooklyn Center, and Columbia Heights now have some of the larger proportions of students who speak a language other than English at home, as well as some of our more rural school districts, such as Sleepy Eye, Westbrook, St. James. Worthington is, in terms of the proportion of students who speak a language other than English at home, Worthington is the second most language-diverse school district in Minnesota. Right now, Minneapolis School District is about 10th in the state, with St. Paul as the highest proportion. With that, my prepared material is complete, but we certainly stand for any questions that you may have.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gillespie, or Dr. Gillespie, thank you for being here today. And, this is the Charter School Working Group. I'm also chairing a working group on integration aid. And so I apologize, but I will be asking you to come back and do the same presentation for that group, because I think that hearing that information will inform our thinking as we develop policy going forward. So I appreciate that. And then a question. As you give us these statistics, how have you factored in the private school population? Do you have access to that data, and how does that change things? And can you do any separation for us with regard to the charter schools versus the traditional schools?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, the school district information, enrollment information I presented here is public school enrollment information that should include the charter schools as well as other public schools. That, as my understanding, it does not include the private schools. There, the information is a little bit fuzzier, and there is some information about private schools. I have worked some with private school councils and organizations in trying to understand some of the trends that they're facing. But the information that we presented here is only of public school enrollment. We do have general population estimates by age and ethnicity and race, as well as survey data that can give us some information about the non-public school age population, although the numbers get small enough that the amount of detail begins to be problematic.
So, Madam Chair and Dr. Gillespie, if you were looking at the data, including looking at just the census data, would that be statistically significant? Would it be different from the data you're giving us here with regard to public schools? How big an impact is, for example, the flight? You know, they talk about that, the flight from the public schools to the private. How big an impact is that having on our public school population?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, as a state average, the public school enrollment data is fairly consistent with the state level population estimates, but that could be quite different from district to district, and I think we'd have to look at specific districts and specific cases as to the potential impact of a shift of students from one system to the next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Gillespie, any information that you do discover on that, I would love to see. Thank you.
And part of this that is not in this report, but I think that we've seen before, is student achievement. And that has been one of the concerns that has been brought up, that as we change, as we have a changing as our demographics change, we're also seeing achievement change, and that's of great concern to us. So looking at those kind of issues. Do you know, Dr. Gillespie, and I'm not sure that this is a question that you can answer, but, you know, has Minnesota ever had been in a situation where we've had such great diversity within our languages? Do you know, I mean, that's maybe more of a historical question, but in terms of demographics, because I think that we're seeing some numbers here that are very different from what we've seen over the past 50 years, and how we've dealt with that. And I think that's the underlying question of this group, is that as we have greater diversity, when we look at some of our charter schools, that they are becoming more culture specific. And that may serve children well and parents well, but in the long term, what are we doing to really address the fact that we're also trying to start to bring people together in our society? So there's this concern about segregation versus integrating children. So do you have any background on that, or?
Madam Chair, members of the working group, certainly the languages have changed, and perhaps the number of languages, but the fact that we have had many different non-English languages in the past is certainly true. In 1900 and 1910, Minnesota had more than 500,000 people who were foreign born. Many of whom did not speak English, and many children who were first generation Americans, and that number was on a smaller population base, actually larger than the number today, which is around 370,000 foreign born people in Minnesota. So we have seen great diversity in the past. With many different languages, we've had governors who grew up speaking languages other than English at home and starting school speaking languages other than English at home. Even within my recollection of being here, there have been governors. So we certainly have seen that kind of diversity before, but the languages have changed. That's not surprising. The European languages, which predominated 100 years ago, that the countries of origin are quite a bit older than we are today, and not experiencing large-scale out-migration as our countries in Latin America and Africa and parts of Asia. So it's not surprising to see a difference in and change in the sort of the focus and locus of that migration.
Very good. Senator Brummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Gillespie, what's different today than 100 years ago, give or take, is the kind of, it seems to me, the kind of work environment we're going to be moving our young people into. It seems to me that the jobs of the future and the orientation of the future is going to be a more knowledge-based, and one of the struggles that I think our schools are having is preparing our new generation of children for that kind of workforce with the language differential. So I think that's something that we have to consider, you know, how are we going to have a workforce that is accessible, not a workforce, a work environment that is accessible to all of our young children, given the language background in their families.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, the forecast that we did of high school graduates in Minnesota was done for the Office of Higher Education. And to be able to do that, we needed to look at long-run trends in high school graduation rate by race and ethnicity in Minnesota. And there, one of the things that we observed is that there are large differences in the high school graduation rates. That's been observed by other people. We're not alone in seeing both the trend and the level of disparity between graduation rates. It is my understanding that high school graduation as a minimum starting point is becoming more critical. That 100 years ago, a person could get by perhaps without a high school graduation, but that's not really possible or not very easy to do today. And some higher education is actually quite important, I think, for most jobs. So a high school graduation rate of 60 or so percent is really astonishingly low. And we are seeing rates at those kinds of levels among some groups. The estimates that we have made as part of this forecasting effort are perhaps a little less conservative than the estimates that the U.S. Department of Education will be, as I understand it, will be focusing on in the methodology that they're proposing that all states adopt, which is a bit more conservative, and will probably lower those numbers a bit, probably not dramatically, but they will lower them some. So there are very large differences. In Minnesota, the Black or African American students, Latino students, and American Indian students graduate at a substantially lower rate than other students. But we have seen perhaps a bit of a decline overall in graduation rates, and that is something that I think many people have looked to and raised concern about, not just in Minnesota, but as a national trend.
Very good. Senator Rummel, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this may not fit into the research you've done, but have some of the folks who've looked at this begun to identify why this decline is occurring? I understand the graduation gap in terms of racial diversity, but even among our white students, are there any speculations about what's going on?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, the one thing that we have identified is that there's a gender gap, that the drops have been mostly among young men, whereas high school graduation rates for young women have remained fairly stable. For young men, they've declined, and that's where most of the decline is.
Excellent. That's a new...
Not an educator, so I, you know, but I think that would be the first place I would look, would be what's happening there. And that's happening across all race and ethnicity groups
right.
that we can find.
Any questions? And a question from Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Gillespie or Dr. McMurray, if you'd like to offer an opinion here, too. You're involved with the census to some extent in planning, and is there any future information as to how we might further refine this information in terms of the questions and how it'll give us better information in the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, we are continuously looking to updated data. Each year, the Census Bureau is putting out a very large sample called the American Community Survey that really has only started in the last couple of years, where we've had fairly good quality data, and that is a major tool, part of what we've used here in looking at some of the trends in the state. We still have some concerns and questions about the nature of the sampling and the weighting and things like that, but as this matures over time, my expectation is that this is going to improve in quality, and by combining years and pooling data, we're looking, for example, right now at data of 2005, 2006, and 2007, which is a very, very large pooled sample, that we can begin to look at more detailed kinds of questions and try to understand some of the dynamics that are happening within specific populations, and perhaps even to be able to further refine the difference between students in public and private schools, which is one of the pieces of information that is available. And I don't know. Do you have any additional?
I think one thing many people are not aware of is that in 2010 there will not be a long form. They won't be asking the education and other socioeconomic questions in 2010. So the future information that we get will come from the American Community Survey.
The good news is that's every year. The bad news is it's not universal. It's not as big a sample.
And are there other questions? So thank you very much for being here today. It's very helpful to have this as our background. And I do want to note to this committee that on Thursday in our full education committee, Dr. Orfield will be coming to present again his report from the Institute of Race and Poverty and having some of that discussion on some of his findings, which have had some sort of mixed reaction. But I think that in our discussion is our charter schools, which are serving certain populations of students in some settings, are they producing the achievement, as are all of our public schools, really encouraging the achievement that we absolutely have to demand in order to meet the future needs of our country in terms of our workforce and our state. So with that, I'd like to have Mr. Fujitake come up, who is from the Bloomington School District, and some of our senators from Bloomington have brought this situation to my attention, and I thought it would be just sort of interesting to hear this situation in Bloomington, because, again, where there's integration, segregation, desegregation, and there's a... I'm not sure if it's a real unique situation, but I think it's something that we should be aware of. How we address it is really a question, I think, to understand what's happening in Bloomington schools. So thank you for being here today, Mr. Fujitake.
Madam Chair, Senators, Good afternoon. My name is Les Fujitake. I'm the superintendent of Bloomington Public Schools. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share information with you that will help, may help with your deliberations. Respect to your time, I'll keep my comments brief. The legislature enacted a policy that required school districts with a racially isolated school to create a plan that had goals and strategies to reduce the racial isolation of that school. The state also provides integration revenue funding to implement that plan. Now, this is a sound policy because research shows that racial isolation has a negative impact on student achievement. The legislature also enacted a policy creating charter schools, giving parents a choice of where their children can receive public education. Another well-intended policy. However, sometimes policy, the results of policy implementation may have unintended consequences. And that was the case here. For example, if a school district has a racially isolated school and they're working very closely with the Department of Education School Choice Department to reduce the racial isolation of that school, and that same Minnesota department is also reviewing an application for a proposed new charter school, and they review it and approve that application, for that school is created within the same neighborhood of that racially isolated school. And the clients that new charter school attracts only intensifies the racial isolation of that school. That only increases the challenge for the school district. So my suggestion is that as you consider possible changes to the law, that you look at maybe considering that the Department of Education include in their review of the of any new applications the impact of that charter school on racially isolated schools within that neighborhood.
So could you give us an example a little bit about what has happened in your district more specifically, and I think it's just to help us understand, because I think you give us a general idea, but again, it's a story that is actually happening and what its impact is on your efforts, and that would be helpful.
We have an elementary school. It's called Valley View Elementary School. It is 80% diverse with over 70% free and reduced. It is one of the most racially diverse, highest concentrations of free and reduced program students in the metro area. It is a racially isolated school, and we've been working with the department to reduce that racial isolation.
So how did you do that, Dr. Fuzitaki?
Did we reduce it?
How did you work on that? So what kind of investments did you make and what kind of
things? There are plans and strategies to create attractive programs to attract families from outside the neighborhood to come into that, to attend that school with it. And the other thing we've done is we have come up with programs that will create intercultural learning opportunities for the students of that school. So students from other neighboring schools can have intercultural learning opportunities. So we have a wide variety of programs. It's reviewed annually by the Department of Education, so we have programs such as that. The challenge is that a charter school proposal for Richfield could not find a location in Richfield. So it had been demonstrated and proven to the department that Richfield school was needed and warranted. Because they couldn't find a location in Richfield, it was transplanted into Bloomington, very close to this racially isolated school. And thereby the clientele attracted to this new charter school intensified the racial isolation of Valley View Elementary. So the work that we're doing there became even more challenging.
So how would you, what was the program in the charter school? What sort of program did it offer, and who are the students who tended to go or who are tending to go to that school?
Well,
and maybe that's a difficult answer.
Their program is a classical type program, educational program, and I believe their latest 0708 diversity percentage is 13%.
13% diversity. So and what is the current diversity at a Valley View school?
And they are 80%.
And did this
and the free and reduced percentage was 70%, and I believe the free and reduced percentage was probably less than 20% at the charter school.
And a question from Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent,
How long has that charter school been in operation?
I believe this is their third year.
And, Madam Chair, Superintendent, has there been any, I've not followed that or tracked with the performance of the school. Has it had any impact on the performance of the racially diverse portion of their clientele? Or
Of Bloomington's clientele, Bloomington Public Schools clientele?
No, the charter schools.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what the impact has been.
But Madam Chair and Superintendent, has it had an impact on the Bloomington school?
Well, it's hard to differentiate the performance because we continually are improving our programming. So we're improving things as we go along. I don't know what it would have been if we hadn't had the challenge of having even more intensity of racial isolation. We could have been performing even better. Valley View Elementary is a high-performing school. We can compare it with any school with similar demographics to the community, and we perform just as well or better than any school.
Madam Chair, Superintendent, you mentioned a pretty strong statement that racial intensity has an impact on the student performance. Is it really the intensity, or does it change the expectations, or is there something that's in the instructional program that makes a difference? Because the assumption, you know, I just have the assumption that all of these kids can learn if they are taught in a way that addresses their needs.
Madam Chair, Senator, I totally agree with you. You're absolutely right. It's not necessarily the diversity percentage, but it is the disparity gap or the free and reduced percentage that has a bigger impact on student achievement. But oftentimes the two are correlated very closely. For example, I told you less than 20% is really 10% for the Classical Academy. That's their free and reduced percentage. I believe it is the disparity gap. A school system can have an outstanding school program, curriculum and instruction program, but it is a disparity gap. Students who are at a disadvantage economically it's not a level playing field. And so we work very closely with our community to try to create a level playing field, addressing basic needs such as health care, food, housing, clothing, and those kinds of extracurricular activities. So those are the things we're working with the community partners to close the disparity gap, thereby closing the achievement gap.
The question, Senator Weger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Dr. Fujitaki, could you elaborate further on your suggestion that the Department of Education consider an impact statement for any new charter school as it relates to the impact on racially isolated schools where that charter school is? And that's one thing for the impact statement. Mm-hmm. And what about the existing charter schools? So either one.
I haven't given much thought on existing charter schools. I can see working with new applications. Existing charter schools, logistically and operationally, I see some real formidable challenges. I'm just looking at the proposed new charter schools. Looking at the integration plan that's been submitted to the department, so they look at the integration plan along with the application of the charter school and see what impact it will have on the achievement of those goals, because we are working with the department to achieve measurable goals on an integration plan to reduce the racial isolation of the school. So if that same department can consider that along with the application, whatever the department decides, that's fine, as long as they look at all the information, not just look at the application of a charter school by itself.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the questions that we've had from parents, and we've had testimony, and it's been, you know, it's been excellent testimony, is talking about that parents want an educational learning environment for their children that is very welcoming.
Right.
And we had a number of African-American leaders from St. Paul talk about the charter school they have there and talking about a welcoming community. I had the director of Cesar Chavez Academy in my office talking about children wanting a very welcoming environment that really reflected all the Latino values. And so as an educator, I'm guessing that in Bloomington, as you see a greater a greater diversity within your students. Is this a trend that we should be going in with all of our public schools, that we are creating these separate schools that reflect the culture of students? Have you read any research that says that is a better learning model than trying to integrate students and ensuring that all students feel welcome in every school? Because I think that if parents feel that they want a more welcoming environment, perhaps something wasn't welcoming about their other school. So I look at this because charter schools have been created to provide for innovation and perhaps give back some feedback on what works best. So if Bloomington schools wanted to proceed in that direction, is that something that you see public schools going, or, and I hate to use the word traditional because I think we have a lot of innovation and good things, and you've just reflected on that. So
this is an issue between choice and integration. Now, my belief has been that Minnesota has had a tradition of excellence in public education because it has had the support of outstanding communities, and that's my definition of that is social capital. We've had tremendous social capital where communities support the public education system. And the strength of that is relationships. And the way you develop that is, I believe, is through the public school system with integrated neighborhood schools where you can develop those relationships and you can create the social capital that's needed. So I'm always for this thing where you can have integrated relationships with students and parents, get to know one another, support the school system, and work together. It has been the foundation of our country to have, this is the one institution that brings people together, the public education system. And if we can do that, that's going to maintain the strength of the school systems in Minnesota, is that integrated approach.
Senator Olson?
But, Madam Chair and Superintendent, you just stated that the charter school has attracted a very integrated population. Why can that not happen? Why can that not happen in the public schools? There's something that they had choice. Now, you were talking about trying to diversify the programs and things so that you could attract people that would change that percentage. Why has it not worked in the public school when obviously the charter school did attract that very variety?
Madam Chair, Senator,
I misunderstood you.
I may have misspoken. The charter school in our neighborhood attracted a lower diversity percentage. It only intensified the racial isolation of an existing school. So it attracted primarily white families to that school. So they didn't come up with an integrated school there. It only intensified the racial isolation.
But Madam Chair and the Superintendent, it intensified the diversity of your school.
Yes, it did.
But the people had a choice. So you had people of varying ethnic groups attracted there. Why doesn't the same happen in your school? We have open enrollment. We have we have all kinds of options. Why when that was in that neighborhood, was that successful in attracting that variety? If it's a tough question, I meant it to be.
Yes.
Well, perhaps I could start, Allison Rolston, and certainly that Dr. Fujitaki can answer that. But I do know that we've also had some. I have been contacted by parents who believe that the Classical Academy tends to be a program that is more attractive to children who have a European ancestry, that the focus of the program is that. So I think that when you say that perhaps it has attracted a more diverse group, when you look at the charter schools that tend to offer that particular curriculum, and this is not a value statement, but when you look at like the demographics of those schools, they tend to be primarily white children, whether that's a good thing or bad thing, whereas another school may have a majority of, say, Latino parents. And that's, I think, the discussion that I'm trying to understand, is that as we create schools that tend to draw certain cultures. Is that a good thing? Because I think that we're trying to understand in our society for many years, we've talked about integration in their public schools really are welcoming to all students. Are we creating schools that are welcoming to a specific culture or group of students? And that may be a good thing if we can show greater student achievement. So that's, and I don't know if there's an answer or response to that. At the very least, part of this committee's hearing and some of the work that we're going to be doing is to just acknowledge this is the trend and how do we feel about that? Because I think that, again, as I said a couple weeks ago at this table, people who are at this table in 10 years, if we're going to more segregated schools, and I think when you do some research and you or just do a Google search and you can pull up articles where in certain parts of the country people are arguing our schools and our society is becoming more separate and segregated. Is that a good thing? Is that something that we should be concerned about? Is that the way our society wants to move? That's the question. And as an education committee, what is our role in maybe monitoring that? So that's
Madam Chair, I was referring to the fact that it isn't totally isolated. You said there was at least, 13%?
Yes.
I mean, that's not zero.
No, it's not zero.
It's not, you know, totally isolated, but there's, what is it that attracts? You're talking about welcoming schools, or what is it that attracts the mixture, or whether people are comfortable in we can call it segregated, or with a common background in learning together? You know, if people are making those choices and they're learning and they're achieving the goals that they need because they can have a program that does accommodate those needs, I don't know why we should worry about it.
Senator Olson, I'm not worried about it. I think that we need to at least acknowledge what are the trends that are going on in our society and how they're impacting. And I think there will be people who will argue that maybe, as Dr. Orfield, and I'm not saying that I agree with him, but I think we should listen to his testimony on that. He may argue that maybe we're not seeing greater achievement. Then again, there will be others who say that we are in specific schools. So just to be aware of that, because it has been a concern that has been raised, and I think we should listen to some of the people who are coming to us who are on the front line with their schools. We ask you to do these kind of programs, and then at the same time, we have policies that really make it much more difficult for you. We tie your hands, and then we, you know, have programs that sort of undo what we've asked you to do. And that's, I think, as Senator Boniff is talking about, we'll be talking about the integration programs, and they do sort of dovetail together. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Boniff, and then Senator Rummel.
So, Dr. Fujitaki, we may call you back in. So, thank you very much.
Excuse me, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your testimony, Dr. Fujitaki. How do you say it, Fujitaki?
Well, first, it's not Dr.
Mr.
Fujitaki.
Thank you. You used an interesting phrase about the impact of charter schools in the neighborhood, and it raised a question that's been in the back. I don't know if the department wants to respond to this or whether this is the appropriate place, but should we, as we open doors to more charter schools, should we be doing some kind of a district or neighborhood impact study, not just on the diversity issue, but even on the capacity of a district to absorb more charter schools? It seems to me that, on the one hand, some of the testimony we've heard is some school districts are having to consolidate because they don't have the capacity, they don't have the population to use the capacity of their district. And at the same time, as soon as they start to do that, some charter school may want to start up. And so we have public funds working at odds. Should we be publicly funding more schools in a district that hasn't got a population to support? I was just intrigued with his phrase, the impact of a charter school, for whatever reason, can we publicly, with public funds, support proliferation of schools when the population doesn't support the schools it has?
If you haven't answered, if for us. You're welcome to
Madam
share
Chair,
with us,
Senator,
Mr. Fujitake.
I agree with that. I believe the more I trust the Department of Education to make sound decisions for the best interests of students and education, and the more information they have in making their decisions and recommendations on charter schools, I'm all for it. So if they have, if doing a some kind of neighborhood impact statement or community impact statement that includes diversity, the impact on racially isolated schools, I'm all for it. The more information they have, the better.
Very good.
Madam Chair.
And Senator Rummel and then Senator Olson.
In your school district, do you have extra capacity for students? I mean, are your buildings used to capacity, or are your buildings, at least in some of the school districts I serve, some of the school districts are losing, just because of the population changes, have smaller populations of students?
Like many school districts in Minnesota, we have had a declining enrollment. Our enrollment has been slightly declining. The challenge is that as we try to get more competitive and offer more programming to be more family-friendly, it requires a lot using space differently and offering different kinds of programs to the community. So that creates, so if you ask if we have extra capacity, yes, we do. But we're rapidly using that capacity to create new programs.
Great. Senator Olson, and then I'd like to go to our next section, if that's possible. Senator Olson?
Well, I had one comment, but Superintendent Fujitake, if you, you've talked about the programs you've added, have you felt the positive impact of those adding those additional choices in your program? Have they had the time to take effect?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, we have. For example, we have a profoundly gifted program. It was written up in this weekend's paper, newspaper, and we attract students from other districts, other communities to come to our school system because we're the only one that offers that kind of programming. It's for the profoundly gifted child.
And Madam Chair, just a comment. Unless we change our policy, we have tended to fund students rather than to fund schools.
And that's an important point, and I think that we're all very concerned about student achievement and how, but we have to think about all students and how one program does impact the education of another. So, Mr. Fujitake, thank you so much. I think you're going to be back at the Capitol. So it's an interesting question. I'd like to call up Sue Freeberg and Ron Goldstein and Marcy Pullman and Wendy Homa. Maybe we can put some extra chairs at the table. One of the areas, the issues we've talked about, some of these questions today talk about welcoming environments, and one of the issues that has been brought forward by parents is charter schools providing special education services and screening children. And so I'd like to invite some parents to the table who have some experience, and I think it's obviously it's just a good time for us to hear about situations and how we may or may not address them, but I think to be aware of some of the concerns that have been brought forward. And these are concerns that we hear about in our district schools as well, but when we give a certain group of school districts greater latitude, that they have some greater flexibility, we want to make sure that flexibility also serves students well within our current statutes. So welcome, and Ms. Goldstein, Ms. Freeberg, if you'd like to start.
Madam Chair, we have a short handout. Can I bring it to the table?
Very good. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, could we please make just one addendum? Ms. Homa is unable to make it as she has an ill child, but she is submitting a written testimony to you.
Good, thank you so much. If you would just identify yourself for the record, that would be great. Thank you.
We're going to start in this one.
Madam Chair, my name is Ron Goldstein.
And you can just continue. Yes.
Okay. My daughter is 19. She's attended two different charter schools over the last 5.5 years, both of them in the St. Paul area. The first was a middle school where she attended grades 7 and 8. I was elected as a parent on the school board, and I was elected by parents and teachers of the school. I came in with an education degree, an MBA, and owner of two small businesses, so I came in with a little bit of knowledge of board activity. What I happened to see when I got on the board as an overview of the charter school was that there were very few people, parents of children with special needs, in the school. And it was the students coming into the school who had special education or who needed special education, transferring from other schools, were basically accepted into the school, but then they were counseled out. And those families were told that the school couldn't teach their children because they didn't have the services, they didn't have the support staff in the school to teach special ed. And we were under the understanding that charter schools were public schools and that they had to accept all comers. And we were a bit surprised that when we were 6 months into the school, that the school wanted my daughter out of the school. And so as a board member of the school, what I saw was some lack of, I guess, professionalism on the board. It was made up majority of teachers. There were 70% teachers, 30% parents. The three of us parents on the board, two of us had gone through the Minnesota Charter School Association board training. The other teachers on the board had not. And at the time, the school was a member of the Charter School Association. And part of that was came with it is the ability to have the Charter School Association do the board training. So what I saw on the board was lack of training of board members or lack of training of teachers, lack of licensing of teachers, and especially special ed teachers. The teachers that we saw that were special ed were on variances, and so they did not have special ed certification. They were temporary special ed teachers. And when I, as a board member and a parent, asked questions of, well, when are they going to be certified, they would delay the answer, and they would ask. Actually, ultimately, they asked me to leave the board because I was asking too many questions. The other thing I saw on the board was administrators hiring family members to be paras in the school, and then management by intimidation, where the coordinators, program coordinators, who were on the board, they were teachers on the board, were basically managing by intimidation, as they wouldn't let other teachers who were new or younger teachers ask questions or talk to parents. And so there became this isolation between us parents who were asking questions, specifically, you know, what kind of things is my child learning at school? What kind of training has the staff had? They became contentious. And then we were known as those parents. And so, you know, rather than, and we're educated. I have an MBA. My wife has a JD. And so they were almost afraid to answer questions that we were asking. We were just asking basic educational questions. You know, what is my child doing in school? And so what we found happening was that board meeting times were changed. This was the second charter school. Board meeting times were changed so that we didn't know when the board meetings were. And teachers not being allowed to talk to parents. And so it became this isolation type of situation. The other thing I noticed was that they were making rules up as they go along. And for instance, the first charter school had a kind of a focus on special education. And their sponsor was District 916, which
provides special ed services. And so there was kind of a conflict of interest because the sponsor of the school was also the school's largest vendor. And so they were providing not only the special education services, but also special education director.
And I just want to note that I believe all of us have received a letter from 916 who have stated they would prefer not to sponsor charter schools, and not because of conflict of interest, because of difficulties dealing with sometimes the school boards. So I just, to clarify that, I think some of us may have a letter from them that we received earlier in the session. So.
Okay. And I think part of that was we brought that issue to light. My daughter aged out of the first charter school, and when I was asked to resign, we started looking at another charter school, a senior high school, grades 9 through 12, also in St. Paul. We live in Plymouth, so for us it was a choice to drive to St. Paul back and forth each day. And we were warmly welcomed, my child was warmly welcomed into the second school. And again, within 6 months, they asked us to leave, or asked my child to leave. So we had a repeating pattern and of situations. Saw the same type of lack of administrative oversight. I approached the sponsor, which was Hamline Law School, approached them and asked them what type of oversight they're providing to the school as a sponsor. And the person who I had talked to said that, you know, we go there and we do a visit once a year, and then the school provides us with a report. And when I questioned the validity of that, she said, well, you know, the report's not public information. And so I again asked, well, isn't this a public school? Isn't this public information? It's public funds. So I think what I would like to close with is that what I see happening in the charter schools, especially with special education, is that there's a barrier for kids who are in special education to enter charter schools. Charter schools are not accepting unless it's a charter school specifically for a child with autism, and then there's a school for that. But there's a lot of kids who are severely mentally impaired, learning disabled, and there's no charter school out there for them. So I think the committee needs to look at stronger oversight of sponsorship and charter schools, a stricter scrutiny of teacher qualifications and licensure, a stricter scrutiny of school board qualifications. And then also, lastly, is more transparency and accountability, specifically regarding the finances of the school.
And just a question, Mr. Goldstein. When you talk about the licensure, I know that the teachers were not certified. Were there any administrators in this school? Were there any folks who were who had licensure as a principal or superintendent? I know that has been one of the questions that has been raised, and that currently charter schools are not required that all teachers have to have licensure, but school directors, principals, some have licensure, but some do not. Did you have an experience with people who did have that type of licensure?
The two schools that we were in, the administrators had no licensure in administrative or superintendent. The first charter school, the director was working on her licensure, but they ended up closing the school. It had financial problems, and before she got her licensure. The second school, they had co-administrators. Both of them did not have license in administration. Okay.
Are there any questions, Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, welcome to the committee, Ron. Ron and I actually worked at a camp together when I was in my late teens. He might have been in his early 20s, so it's nice to see you here.
See you.
And I appreciate hearing both your testimony. It sounds like that was an awful experience, and I'm sorry that in our public schools that you had that experience, and so I'm appreciative that we're looking at this.
Very good.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wieger.
And thank you, Mr. Goldstein, for sharing this. Did you ever bring your case to the Department of Education?
Many times.
And could you elaborate on that appeals process?
We filed a number of complaints. The complaint the last complaint that we filed with MDE came back, and they said that there wasn't anything that they could do about it at this point, and that there was actually the first school that we went to filed a due process against us to have my daughter removed from the school, which it was settled before it went to due process. The second charter school filed a due process against us as well.
So, Ms. Goldstein, do you have more to add to this story? I know that perhaps if you want to share with us your perspective, that might give us a complete picture, and then we may have some questions.
Why don't I continue our time? Hi, my name is Susan Freeberg, and thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak with you. I think as I was listening to my husband speak about this issue, I thought, oh, my God, those parents. How did the school deal with those parents? So I would like to reiterate that we are very committed, actually, to the charter school movement in many, many manners, in many ways. I think we have three children, all of who attended public schools, two are graduates of Wayzata High School and Gustavus Adolphus College. The youngest is 19. She's currently in a transition program. We've attended charter schools for the past 5.5 years. I think you heard a little bit of our struggles. We were quite taken aback by our struggles, actually. We were simply seeking a smaller environment in which for our daughter to learn. And we saw that as a charter school, a school of choice, as a viable option for her. And I think that it starts out very well. I mean, there's a lot of parents in our position that go to the charter school as per their choice because they are welcomed initially. They come with their federal, state, and local dollars. As you say, we fund students, not schools. But that is not really the choice that the students with special needs have. I think I'd like to say that, as I said, we first support the charter school concept when it's done well with licensed administrative leadership and at least comparable scrutiny of teacher competencies. The task force has heard from several charter schools that, and they do it well. I've listened to all the testimony of the work group since beginning of last December and attended several of your hearings. Unfortunately, this does not appear to be the majority of charter schools. It said good, tight administration and fiscal management is not the norm. We sought a charter school education for our daughter because of the reasons you've heard about the testimony here before about innovation, small lab school setting, community-oriented parent involvement. Our older boys went to a very good public school, but there's 3,500 students there, and we felt sincerely that and honestly she would be lost there. So we sought an alternative which we thought was viable for her. But we found out that once she was accepted, I would go so far as to say she was welcomed. We did our research. I have gone at least to 12 to 15 charter school orientations, done tours, everything. She's a student that needs special education services to learn. It's pretty obvious, and I think that is what he spoke to. But as concerned parents, taxpayers, and myself, the daughter of a long-time public school teacher, we ask the questions that this task force has been asking. We ask this of the school. We ask about accountability. We ask about transparent decision-making, welcoming all students. And we're met with a subculture like we've never seen before. And we kept trying to figure out why was this happening. And it wasn't just us singled out as parents. It was many parents of students with disabilities. We were the ones who chose to stay, I think, to hopefully change the system for the better for children like our daughter. The demographics of the last school we were at, the last charter school in St. Paul, had 20%, according to the auditor's report, to that of students with special needs. We hope that with this degree of students and their demographics that we could do a better job. But this is information you can't understand only by looking at charter school textbooks and saying it's not religious, or looking at an annual report of sponsors, or a one-time visit to a charter school prepared solely about the charter school for the sponsor that's prepared solely by the school. That's done on a frequent basis. This is information on diversity and data collection that comes from being at a charter school on a daily basis, seeing how all students are treated, seeing how all parents are treated, talking to parents, paraprofessionals. This is seeing that the person was a paraprofessional 1 year, and the next year she appears on the doorstep as a community expert special ed teacher. It was a grave concern to us as parents when there's 20% of the school population that this community expert variance was being used in this manner at this school. The appearance of compliance without substance, without looking at fidelity of implementation, without assurance of implementation, only encourages and allows for greater segregation and elitism in charter schools. The research is solid on students with special needs and students without special needs. There is greater achievement when there is inclusion, well-supported inclusion. We distributed an example of innovation that can take place at a charter school. It does have our daughter's name on it. It's a recent piece of information, but it's about educating a student with different learning needs. Unfortunately, this is the same charter school that used over $100,000 of education tax dollars in a due process against our daughter and our family. The state spent an additional $30,000 tax dollars on a hearing officer. Was it an inherently bad charter school? No. Did it have uninformed, underinformed teachers? Yes. Did it have licensed administrators at the helm? No. Was it a gross misuse of tax dollars? And could it? Yeah, absolutely. Could a tenth of these dollars been spent to effectively train the teachers to teach diverse learners, whether it be race, ethnicity, or disability, to teach each child to succeed, to welcome all children? Absolutely. It can be accomplished with legislation that addresses real oversight, no teacher majority on boards, and holding charter schools to comparable scrutiny of all public schools. Thank you. Questions, please?
Who's heard of the ice cream story, the blueberry ice cream story, about there was a businessman from Des Moines, Iowa. He used to come up here and speak about community building, and he ran a really successful ice cream company in Des Moines, Iowa. And he used to go to the schools and say, if you only ran your schools like a business, you could do much better. And he went to some community meeting, and a parent stood up and said, Mr. Vollmer, I have a question for you. She said, you know, you make the best ice cream in town, don't you? And he said, yes. And he said, I get the best ingredients, and I look out everything. And talked about the blueberries that come when he makes his famous blueberry ice cream, and they're the best, most perfect blueberries in town. And she says, well, let me tell you about when we invite children into our schools. We invite them all. We invite every one of them, whether they come in whatever their ethnic background, whatever their special needs, but all of them bring value to our community. And in listening to your story, I would suggest that this is a situation where all children, children have not been welcomed. And I think it really underscores what we've talked about today a little bit, is making sure that all children feel welcome in every school. And special education is certainly another topic for this, but I think it's an important one because all schools, our district schools, welcome, or we hope that they welcome all children. And I know that parents with children with special needs also have battles with our district schools on appropriate services, and we appreciate that. But your story is very disturbing, and I appreciate you sharing it with us today.
Thank you for listening. Marcy?
So, Ms. Pullman?
I am Marcy Pullman.
Do you want
to
pull your microphone just a little closer?
How's that?
It's a little even closer. There you go. There. Thank you very much.
Okay. I am Marcy Pullman. I am the parent of a student with disabilities who is now in college. I also taught special education at Illinois State University's laboratory school many years ago. I'm also a retired CPA, and I've worked in both public and private accounting businesses. I appreciate this opportunity to accompany Susan and Ron to testify. I have served as Deborah's advocate for many years, and I have stood beside them through trials and tribulations in their charter schools. I would like to say on their behalf that they are committed, passionate, generous, courageous parents. But I think this demonstrates pretty well what can happen when there is inadequate oversight of a charter school. You know, the attributes that parents look for in a charter school, and the reasons they go to a charter school when they have a student with a disability, like the smaller school size and fewer levels of administration to get through in order to collaborate, are also attributes that can create a culture of such narrow vision and misconception that it encourages segregation and exclusion of students. And I believe that's what happened here at Avalon Charter School. The teachers were not adequately licensed, prepared, trained in special education. The teachers in regular education did not have a good understanding of what special education means, of what parent involvement is required by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. It pretty much served to trump upon the students' and these parents' civil rights. They were accepted into the school without reservation, but then, you know, a couple months down the road, they had to fight to convince the school that their daughter should not be plopped into a wheelchair for the whole day, which was convenient for the teachers, but it's exactly what all their medical service providers had recommended against for 18 years. And it took two or three meetings of heated discussions to convince them of that. The staff and the teachers there would accept the Goldsteins' donations of theater tickets and whatnot, but they would totally reject their knowledge and their offers of resources and training potential and possibilities. They basically became the scapegoat for untrained and unprepared staff. So, you know, I guess what I would hope that you could take away from this is that, you know, what happened at Avalon School, I believe partly happened because the teachers were also the administration. They were the head teachers. They were the school board. They were the, marshals of the sponsor report, which pretty much made up the sponsorship overview. So I would appeal to you to change the requirement that charter schools have a majority of teachers. I don't know how teachers can monitor or provide oversight for themselves. Coming from an accounting and auditing background, I have an understanding of internal controls, and I know internal controls have been talked about a lot around here lately, but I believe they really extend beyond the financial aspects, because they're there to ensure that a system and processes are working and that errors will be detected in time before they become pervasive and persistent. And that's pretty much, that did not work at Avalon because there were no oversight or internal controls. And the deficits in the teachers' knowledge and skills became pervasive and persistent, and they were not willing to allow outsiders in, and it created quite a culture or a subculture, as Susan referred to it. And I don't know how you get past that. Again, IDEA requires that parents be involved in the educational decisions. That, you know, is sometimes hard for our regular public schools to embrace, but it's even more difficult when a charter school staff has no inkling of how that even can work or should work. And we really need some kind of independence from our school boards and from our sponsors that can look at what's going on with a real discerning eye and look at it for substance, not just appearance. I think Susan mentioned that the reports, you know, everything looks like the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, but that's not always the internal story. And that's part of the problem with, or not problem, but the situation with the IDEA, the Federal Act for Children with Disabilities in Education, is that it's a procedural law. And parents are the ones who are really looking at the implementation and the success or the outcomes of the implementation. And it's, you know, we have the whole alternative dispute process in place for us to call attention to that. But quite often we get a bad rap when we try to exercise those rights. So I guess that's my message and my request, is that we strengthen the framework of charter school oversight and we get some independence and some internal controls in there to prevent what happened here from happening again. You know, this isn't a school that was in the headlines about financial problems or issues.
Are there some suggestions, because of your experience of trying to work with a sponsor, of there's been some discussion about giving sponsors more authority. There's been some proposals that if sponsors were able to charge a higher sponsorship fee to raise what they now receive, that they could do a better job. Do you have any insight as to is that the direction that we should be going? What should a good sponsor be doing? Should they be an advocate for the administration or an advocate for the students and families? Should there be some sort of process in place so that if there's a dispute right now, you know, if you have a dispute with a school or a school district, you can go to the school board, and which is a fairly public process. And then you can certainly go on to the state level and exercise that. But do you see any additional role for the sponsor, how we would structure that, Ms. Friedberg?
I do. When I listened to several models that were proposed during the task force discussions, and one was that MDE was going to authorize the sponsors or authorizers, as it's being called in the new legislation, and then subsequently they would be responsible for the authorization and oversight, more heavy oversight. I think that depends on the educational level and the level of commitment, both from, particularly from MDE. If they're going to become knowledgeable about this process and hold the sponsors accountable, because I think to become a sponsor or an authorizer in face only, I said, is not going to serve the children well. And I think that's why all three of us are up here, is because we care about the children that in the public schools, all public schools. And we're here because of the charter school issue, but we need to have this accountability and this someone actually looking at what's going on in the charter schools in terms of the model. And they do have at MDE, that was what Ms. Holman was going to speak to, because she has participated in the training at MDE. And it spoke to a very, very narrow population of students, and that was her concern. And I think that that's what we need. If it's going to work, if we're going to give sponsors more more money, I guess, what are we going to get for that? That's my question in terms of how is it going to benefit the students that these schools are intended to serve, all diverse populations, and not be allowed to take that elitism another level and allow that to persist. Because I think one thing is going to be accountability. I think more stringent scrutiny of what's going on. If MDE is going to be authorizing sponsors, and subsequently sponsors are going to authorize charter schools to form and exist, then there has to be a clear line of authority and accountability throughout that process, which does not currently exist.
But Senator Olson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate your comments and reflections, as well as recommendations. And I was, since I was around here and a co-author of the original charter school law, I was trying to reflect back on what the rationale was of making the boards a majority of teachers. I think part of it, and I see Mr. Bartholomew here might be able to correct me if I'm wrong. I think the charter movement was originally envisioned to be opportunities for teachers that in their own professionalism that had ideas that were kind of hamstrung by the structure and the regulation within the public schools, and yet allowing them greater freedom, and therefore somewhat similar to the movement that we've had too of site-based management, of giving them more control over what was happening and being able to carry out and follow through with some of their innovations. But as things have moved, we've had for a number of years have had efforts to make a change in that, to not require that there be a majority, of just opening that door. And I recently don't remember what the form or where I saw the if it was a letter to the editor or if it was an email that I got on this very subject of saying that they saw that it was a direct conflict of interest to have teachers on the board. I think it's a different vision of what the role of the board is than what was maybe initially envisioned. And then taking the link further to what's been happening in many of industry is that instead of having internal members on the board, they're moving away from that to have external members on their boards and saying that maybe we ought to not allow teachers to be on the boards. I mean, that's just kind of a full circle. And so, I'm not sure, if what we're evolving to, if it's the same structure as the regular schools, if we're going to get away from some of the innovation, or maybe that just doesn't work and you still, human beings being what they are, really do need some to have an entity that, and you're absolutely right, I think, on the preparation. Board members need training. The School Boards Association, I think, tries to do that with board members, but you often will get people that are, operating in a function that is not what really is the role of a board member. And, we do need that all along the way. So I appreciate the comments you've made, and I don't know if you have any reactions or reflections to the idea of moving away from teachers altogether or having them on or just opening that door that a majority isn't required.
Madam Chair, if I might respond to this.
Yes.
Great. Please do, Mr. Goldstein.
My accountant is the chairman of the board of Teachers Federation Credit Union, Teachers Federal Credit Union. We had this discussion. When he started the board 14 years ago, it was 70% teachers, 30% non-teachers. It's changed because there are less teachers with deposits at the credit union. And also they've had to change because of the times, the banking system. I think education's the same way, is when you have more teachers on the board, there's less innovation, less outside community involvement, You have less professionals, accountants, lawyers, bakers, other members of the community involved in the decisions of the school. And so I think what's happened is the concept of having the teachers as the majority was probably good at the time. It's changed. And we've noticed also by direct experience of being on the board that you have to have more community people, more parents involved. When my parents, the generation of my parents started schools, they built the schools, they were strongly involved in the school board. And so I think that's the right model, is we have to have more parents, more community members involved, less teachers involved on the boards.
Can I make one comment? I think the model, when we originally, I think the model in theory has a lot of positives with it. When you look at, in Henderson, the New Country Day School, I think Dee Thompson down there, she's both a teacher and but has an administrative license.
Yes.
I think those are formulas that work. And we were very much encouraged by that school, her and that school visit, and the Ed Visions involvement with that school. That was originally the component that was to be at the school at Avalon. They were originally Ed Visions. And I think what their schools are also moving away from that original vision and mission statement and that accountability for that. And the teachers that may have originally started that school with that type of mission and vision for all the students and the staff working collaboratively, there's become a large disparity in those original missions. So I don't want to be negative about all charter schools. That is not our purpose here. But I think the models at work, they need to be looked at. They are innovative. She's done a good job. So I'd say in the teacher aspect, it has to be with administrative experience.
And that's a very important point, because we are here to strengthen charter schools. I think that's something that we've said repeatedly. And in doing that, you ask difficult questions and you hear stories that need to be addressed, and especially when they're not all schools. But we also want to make sure that other parents don't have to go through the same experience. And Deborah, thank you for being with us today as well. We welcome you to the state capitol, and we're here for you. So we do appreciate you being here, and your parents are speaking on your behalf today, and very strongly. So we appreciate that. I would like to have, and thank you so much for coming, and we certainly would appreciate your input. And as we look at some of the proposals, I think that you've given us some good ideas. I think there's been several suggestions that perhaps we look at the administrative licensure, because it's not just about running an organization. It is about educational programming and having people who understand what that means, beyond the fact if you have kids who don't have special needs. Those who do need to be able to have the programming that they require and need and should have. So we appreciate that very much. And Ms. Anderson, you're here today. And I do want to note that the department, we have had met with them earlier, and I'm not sure that this really came up in this discussion today, but there have been questions that on some charter school applications that information has been requested in advance of, say, a lottery that may identify children who have special needs or come from families who have some language issues. And so I think we want to hear from the department and also, Ms. Anderson, if there are things that we can do to help the department, because I know that in some situations what we have in current statute really ties your hands in being able to respond to situations, and that the department is trying to listen but has to sometimes follow specific procedures in responding. It makes it look like you're not responding as quickly as you would like. So, and I think that will be reflected in your department bill as well. So,
sure. Madam Chair, members of the working group, my name is Chaz Anderson. I'm the deputy commissioner at the department. First, I just want to clarify the process the department goes through to approve sponsors and charter schools. Currently, in current law, a sponsor has to be a school district, a higher education institution, or a nonprofit that has at least a $2 million general fund balance and is registered at the AG's office and the Council of Nonprofits. And once they become then a sponsor, if they want to authorize a charter school, they have to go back to the department with a separate application. and request that, and then the commissioner can approve or disapprove that application. Under the proposal that the department has worked out, what we're trying to do is it's not going to fundamentally change the process, but it's going to create higher standards to become a sponsor. So all of those eligible sponsors I just listed will have to meet additional standards in order, and they will have to demonstrate they have the capacity to oversee the charter schools they are planning to oversee. So what we're trying to do right now, we have 56 sponsors. They vary in quality. We have high-functioning sponsors. We have low-functioning sponsors. And what we're trying to do is have all of our sponsors be high-functioning. And we think by having higher standards in place and holding those sponsors accountable, the department will ultimately have higher-functioning charter schools. You asked me to come by and discuss sort of this issue as it relates to special education and enrollment in charter schools. Charter schools are public schools. They're required to provide what's known as FAPE, a free appropriate education for all students. And one thing that we've noticed, and I do have some guidance for the committee if they'd like to take a look at it. I think I emailed it to you earlier. Mm-hmm. We did notice that in a number of charter school applications, they were asking for information prior to enrollment and then making decisions about enrollment based on the information provided. For example, they asked for the student's special education status, their race, their age, their ethnicity, and specifically the charter school law prohibits this, and it also is prohibited under the Human Rights Act. In Minnesota Statute 124D10, which is the charter school statute, subdivision 8, charter school must comply with the Human Rights Act, it states. Also, in subdivision 9 of the charter school statute, it states a charter school may not limit admission to pupils on the basis of intellectual ability, measures of achievement or aptitude, or athletic ability. And so what we did in response to that, it was one specific complaint the department received, and then in looking at other charter school enrollment applications, we noticed the same problem. The charter school was requiring students to fill out this identifiable information and then also write an essay prior to admissions into the charter school. So what this memo basically says, that is prohibited. You can only ask for basic information of a student prior to enrollment, and then once you admit that student for enrollment, you may ask for the information about the special education status or other information that's necessary to be collected. However, that information that's collected must be separate from the admission of enrollment. Now, there is cases where a charter school is full, where they have a lottery system. They cannot accept either at the grade level or school-wide. And, they have too many students wanting to get in for enough slots. And so in that case, which is outlined in this memorandum, if you go to page 3, Roman numeral 3, what happens when charter schools have legitimate enrollment limits, they must conduct a lottery. Now, they can have some exceptions to that lottery under state law. Right now, if a sibling has preference in a lottery, if that happens. So there's some exceptions to that, but the lottery must be conducted without regard to race, gender, intellectual ability, special education status. So it must be neutral of that. And then once that lottery is conducted, and then there's a waiting list. So if a parent decides not to enroll the student, the next student on the waiting list may enter the charter school. So the charter school board is required to have a policy for a lottery system, how it's going to be conducted, when it will happen, how it will happen. That's very important. We do find that sometimes charter schools do not have policies, so we try to help them develop those model policies. As this committee will probably hear shortly, you'll hear the department's bill change, our law changes to the charter school law. You'll hear probably the MAX organization recommendations. What we're trying to do is change the landscape of sponsoring in charter schools. So instead of the department having to provide oversight of 150 schools in a way that we really do not do for regular school districts, we're trying to have sponsors who are higher functioning providing that oversight, and the department then oversees the sponsors. And there's a language in the bill that requires the sponsors to report back to the department. They're reviewed every 5 years for performance. So if you become an approved sponsor or authorizer under this bill, you would have to have your authorization reviewed once every 5 years by the commissioner. And so we're trying to align the accountability, and because right now it's not clear who is accountable, because we have situations where sponsors are not providing oversight, and in that case then the department has to step in, and which I believe is an extraordinary role to basically manage a school, which we're not equipped to do as a state agency very well. And so what the law is trying to do that, our bill changes are will try to attempt to do that. The other issue is with compliance. A lot of times you heard testimony about, you know, the charter school wasn't complying with this provision or that provision. The law, actually, the bill changes that we're recommending, which actually passed the full legislature last year, provides this, the commissioner with additional authority to step in and withhold aid until compliance is met. And I think that is, we have it in particular areas. For instance, if charter schools are hiring unlicensed teachers, we can withhold aid. But in a lot of areas of the law, simply there's no provision for, you know, what, there's no accountability, no, basically, right, for complying with what really the commissioner or what the law states. The other issue is conflict of interest. You heard some of those issues come up. We're also proposing some substantial changes to the conflict of interest. You heard of a sponsor who was a contractor to the school, the school's largest contractor. Right now, they only have to the conflict of interest only arises if it's a for-profit entity. We're clarifying that to say if it's a non-profit entity. So you've heard that in previous testimony with building corporations. They're non-profits, so they're not subject to any conflict of interest. In this case, the school district was providing services and was a large contractor. So we're just trying to clean up some of those provisions now that we've had a good 15 years, 16 years of having charter schools in existence. Sometimes these situations were never contemplated when the law was first written. And so we're just reflecting sort of practice that has happened in trying to address these issues.
Very good. We really appreciate that. And I think that, you know, today there was some more testimony that really sort of makes me question, you know, how do sponsors know what's going on? There's a school board, and then we have a sponsoring agency or organization, and how do they really understand and know what is happening in that school? Are they on the board? Are they attending board meetings? That's, I think, a question that we might want to pursue a little bit more, and especially because they're asking for additional dollars to do some sort of oversight, but is more money going to address the issue and how we ensure that that's happening? Are there questions for Ms. Anderson?
Yes, Madam Chair, a quick question.
Senator Weaver.
Deputy Chair Anderson, there was a recommendation earlier by Dr. Fujitake on a possible change in law requiring a fiscal or an impact statement, looking at the impact on integration for racially isolated districts where a charter school might further compound a segregation issue. Any reaction to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Weaver, we have had discussions with the Bloomington superintendent about this issue. It's very difficult because in the law, the department has to show cause of intentional isolation, intentional being difficult sometimes to prove that that happened. The governor, as you know, has recommended freezing funding for the integration program in sort of a timeout to look at the rule and look at the statute we've had in place for at least the new rule for about 10 years. Is it really effectively providing resources and closing the achievement gap for students that are behind? And so our position is we think the whole integration rule and statute needs to be rewritten. I know there's working groups in the House and Senate. We're working closely with them and with stakeholders, and we would rather, at this point, focus our attention on rewriting that rule and statute. But we're certainly willing to take a look at what's being proposed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, with that, I think that we are adjourned. I want to thank everyone for being here today. It was a good discussion, and I really want to to the parents who came today, thank you so much for sharing your stories. I think that we've heard a lot from staff, administrators, and you know, opponents and also proponents of different policies, but I think it's always very important when we have the face of parents and students before us. So we really appreciate that. So with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you.
Senator, how are you?
I'm doing well.